No one would have believed in the last years of the 19th century that this world was being watched keenly and closely by intelligences greater than man's, and yet as mortal as his own. That as men busied themselves about their various concerns, they were scrutinized and studied, perhaps almost as narrowly as a man with a microscope might scrutinize the transient creatures that swarm and multiply in a drop of water. With infinite complacency, men went to and fro over this globe about their little affairs, serene in their assurance of their empire over matter. So begins one of the great science fiction classics, The War of the Worlds, which H.G. Wells wrote in 1898 and which has been reinterpreted from one generation to the next ever since. What makes it stick in our collective imagination? I'm Norman Gilliland.
And I'm Emily Auerbach. This is University of the Year.
What made a 19th century novel so frightening to so many people when it turned up as a radio adaptation in 1938? How has it been put to use in the years since that notorious broadcast? If it works so well as prose and radio, how does The War of the Worlds fare as film and on stage? And what does it offer us today? Well, our guests have some insights into the War of the Worlds phenomenon, past and present. They are Tony Simotas, director of the upcoming University Theater production of War of the Worlds, Bethany Wood, one of the dramaturgs and the assistant director for the production, and we have also, eventually during the hour, two of the actors, Sarah Lyons and John Hawes.
Welcome to University of the Air.
Oh, it's good to be here.
Thank you.
In a way, the panic that ensued after the broadcast of War of the Worlds is a testament to the power of art, isn't it?
I think so. It's really amazing that we work so hard, and I think in our business, to do things that obviously bring people into the theater and that entertain them and get them to think about sometimes larger issues. Because today there's so much emphasis put on, is the show a success? We sometimes lose sight of the fact that theater and entertainment really lives on a much deeper level for us, I think, as human beings. It's not just about a clever story and, will the boy get the girl in the end, that kind of thing. It really lives on a psychically deep level in terms of what, obviously, I believe we as human beings need. I mean, I think the Greeks were really onto something years ago when everybody in town came to see the plays and they dealt with large issues and sometimes funny issues. And so the fact that the War of the Worlds made a lasting impression, a deep impression on society, I think is truly a testament to the kind of story it is and the way that it really delves into the psyche of human beings.
Do you have a sense, Bethany, of how the original H.G. Wells novella, I guess you'd call it, attracted attention back in 1898?
Well, it was originally done as a magazine serial, and so Wells developed it through that process and eventually published the novel, which was a bit of a hit, and that's due in part because of the developments in science at the time and also fear of the Germans and coming war. So there was the military aspect that people were interested in as well as the sci-fi.
And he set it in London, right?
Yes, it's really set in London, and the aliens land in the north and start heading towards London. And he, just as Koch did with his adaptation, picked real locations, which was something of a novelty. Sci-fi was usually set in fictional places with locales that no one had ever heard of. So to have something that was set in places that people were familiar with was new, and that was very exciting. So Wells actually taught science before he started writing, so he always, a lot of his novels, The Time Machine, The Island of Dr. Moreau, all have this unity of science and the magic what if, what is possible with science.
He was quite a broad writer. I mean, if just go to the library, you see how many board feet of H.G. Wells novels, many of them science fiction of one kind or the other and others not. I mean, he wrote history and all kinds of things, a Renaissance man in a literary sense. But this piece is probably the best-known Wells there is.
Yes, and that's due in large part to Orson Welles' radio broadcast. Originally, H.G. Wells was not pleased with the radio broadcast, and he complained that it was not what he was told. He expected it just to be his novel read over the air, and he claimed he was never told that it would be adapted. So he originally complained, and then later, when the broadcast started to boost sales of his book, he became much more accepting of the adaptation.
Oh, all right.
Okay, thank you very much.
Yes, and 2 years later, he actually met Orson Welles, and they were interviewed together, and he jokingly referred to the radio broadcast and was quite fine with it by that time, but initially he was not pleased.
It's hard to talk about the Welles without specifying which one. You know, it's odd that they have Orson Welles and H.G. Wells both involved in this. Can you talk about this young Orson Welles and how he came upon this story and what he made of it and how... Yeah.
I'll just start briefly. From my point of view as an actor many years ago, and I think of when looking at a man who was so young at the time, I think it was, what, 24, 23?
23.
23. Mm-hmm. And when this happens, and it was amazing the kind of talent and genius he had, as well as working with such great theater artists at the time in New York with the Mercury Theater, that they were really – they were renegades. I mean, they were really trying to shift American theater. They had a lot of brash young talent around them, and I really think it kind of fit with the spirit of kind of like the American psyche at that time to change theater, to change the way people were looking at Broadway and theater at that time.
What was that Julius Caesar that Orson Welles did? That came before War of the Worlds, and that was something that made his reputation too. I think it was just a 20th century setting of Julius Caesar or something like that that was quite provocative and very, very popular.
Well, I think what you mentioned earlier about the idea of science and theater, and I think the part that we sometimes don't realize is that when science and the arts work together, like as Shakespeare was that way in terms of new lands and exploration yeah. and in the inventiveness of his language and the things that he was talking about in terms of science really made a difference for the Renaissance as well and for the Elizabethans themselves. And so here we have another situation where artists coming together, working with science, somehow explodes the art in a way that really brings it into right into the kind of like what our life is. Really, they collide in a way which really creates sparks and a creative spark in a way. So that's why I wanted to make sure we say something about Welles, because I think that was important at that time with Orson Welles and what his theater was doing politically in American theater on the stage.
And if we look at 1938, what was important in America at that point that helps us understand the panic that ensued or even why Orson Welles would put it together in this way?
Well, Orson Welles actually didn't like the idea of War of the Worlds to begin with, but they were doing the Mercury Theater on the air and did literary adaptations. They had done Tale of Two Cities, Treasure Island, and he was looking for something a little different and handed the book to Howard Koch to adapt. And Koch brought in the script, and Welles thought it just wasn't quite enough. So he decided to add the radio reports that were breaking in. And then when it was broadcast to an audience in America that was relatively new to mass media, relatively new to radio, and had this, as was evident by the panic, implicit faith in the media. And so that combined with the tensions around the war, just 30 days before the broadcast was the Munich Pact. And so everyone had been very nervous about what was going on in Europe and felt that war had been averted, and what a relief that was. But everybody knew there was still potential for Germany to come back. And
there's mention of a war scare actually in the opening monologue.
In the script. I think
the war scare was over.
Right. Men were back at work. Things were looking up.
Real news.
To the Depression, which America was still recovering from. People were used to insecurity and unbelievable things really happening. A lot of people compare it to broadcasts of 9/11. Just absolutely unthinkable things were becoming real. And so when they heard what they thought were real news reporters reporting on a Martian invasion, a lot of them believed that it was true. It's estimated that 1.2 million people believe that there was an actual invasion. And some people thought that the news reporters had just gotten it wrong and it was actually Germany with some very bizarre machines.
Germany, Mars,
right.
Sure. Hard to tell apart on a dark night.
Exactly.
Well, I know that I had the opportunity to talk to both my mom and dad, who are still alive. They're 80, 84 and 82. Sorry, Mom. And But I asked them, I said, you know, do you guys remember when this was broadcast? And they both lit up and just were like, oh, my God, that was one of the most terrifying nights in our life. And as I even say in my director's notes, it was just a few short years later where my father was actually fighting in the war. But just even at that time, they really believed it. They grew up, they were in Joliet, Illinois, and my mom lived out in a farm in Yorkville, Illinois, a very small community. And, you know, the radio was everything to them. And said when they heard this, they were quite frightened that what was actually going on and the debate in the household of was it real or was it not real? You know, and so – and of course, today you can't like rewind. So as I'm sure as they were arguing, as my family can, I'm sure they missed certain things, like even in the broadcast where it says, this is not real.
Right. Yeah, no, it was Halloween. How important was that to them?
The night before Halloween.
Yeah. Right.
I think in the panic, nobody really thought about it. I mean, if people had thought about it rationally, they could have checked the guide and seen, oh, well, it's War of the Worlds tonight. That's what this is. But, you know, of course, people that were panicked and fleeing weren't listening to the radio by the time it got to the part that said it was fake.
Right.
And a lot of them were trying to phone relatives. And then, of course, they were clogging the lines. And when they couldn't get through, they assumed that that was because the Martians had torn down the lines. And
because there was discussion of that in the
news
bulletins. Yes.
Yeah. I mean, there's the news reporter saying the Martians are tearing them down and we can't get through, so clearly it's true. And Wells also added effects in the acting, like people that couldn't quite be heard on the microphone, technical difficulties, experts. And one of the, as Houseman later said, naughtier things that they did is they had a Secretary of the Interior that spoke, and they deliberately tried to make the secretary sound like FDR. And they said every fifth word was supposed to sound like FDR.
Well,
so.
Which is amazing because since I'm doing that voice, I'm definitely trying to do FDR.
Which is
my fellow American.
And of course, after the panic, they denied it completely. Said, no, no, we weren't trying to do
that
at all.
There are a few inconsistencies, aren't there, between what they said immediately after and years later in terms of, oh, we weren't trying to imitate FDR there. There were a couple of others that were a little inconsistent there. But FDR, you have to remember, too, was the first president really to use radio.
Mm-hmm.
And he was so effective at using radio that when you have somebody who sounds like FDR, the most authoritative voice in America.
Right. That they're used to hearing, yeah. But the part of the inconsistencies are due to the fact that there was such an outrage the day after the broadcast.
Who was going to own up to it?
Yes, the news media was furious. And even during the broadcast, they were getting calls to shut it down, and Orson Welles refused. And the news media was irate. And some people say that that's because they were upset that radio was taking business away from newspapers. But you can hear the interview that they did with Welles the day after, and they are mean. And they were asking questions like, well, Mr. Welles, you know that your radio broadcast killed hundreds of people. How do you feel about that? Which wasn't true. Nobody was actually killed as a result. And one reporter asked him, well, don't you think there should be a law against things like this? And he's very defensive but polite. And he says, well, I don't know what that law would be. And he explains. And then he says that was just amazed that a story that's familiar to children would frighten people like these fine, upstanding news people that are asking him questions. So he kind of turns it back on them. But a lot of the inconsistencies are a result of lawsuits after for damage and things like that. And one man said that I think he had spent his savings, which was $3.95, on a bus ticket to flee the Martians. And by the time he found out it wasn't true, he'd already lost his money on the ticket. And he told Orson Welles he was saving that money for a pair of black shoes. And his Welles' lawyers told him not to respond, but Orson Welles sent him a pair of black shoes. So,
well, it's interesting to look at the accounts of people who then said they saw fire or smelled the gas, or, you know, the sort of eyewitness reports of people who sort of were influenced by what they were hearing on the broadcast.
People shooting at
it was a water tower.
Right.
That they saw every day, but it's night and they're panicked and they got their guns and went and shot the water tower.
And we laugh, but in a sense, it could happen. I mean, maybe we shouldn't laugh at it because all of us are capable of believing something that's not real and becoming hysterical, right?
Oh, I think so. I think that was the whole thing that really, you know, ultimately, you know, drew me to this project was that I remember very distinctly certain things that in my own life frightened me. things of, and I mentioned again in my director's notes about when I was a child I had to go down and fill the stoker, fill the furnace. It was the, coal, and it was crushed coal, and you had to throw it in the stoker, and the stoker then took it into the furnace. Well, every night I had to go down and fill that bushel basket full of coal. I kept waiting for something to come up out of the coal and then opening the stoker and watching it grind it into the fire. You know, there's all those images as a kid. And of course, my brother and sister were tormented me with things that were going to be waiting for me in the basement. And I'd go downstairs, they'd turn the lights off, and then my sister would scream, and it was, and they would lock me in the basement. I mean, it was, all the things that brothers
explains
and
a lot,
do.
Tony.
Well, and it's the kind of thing. So when I look at this project, I knew that the basement was safe. And, of course, my father was always like, stop tormenting your brother. But it's kind of like when you're frightened, all of a sudden anything is possible. And I think, that goes along with where we are today. Once a nation is frightened, anything becomes possible. And, we give up freedoms. We do different things that we might not normally do. And this piece of art really showed that how an incident, if truly believed, could just change people in a moment.
It's interesting that you say that, because Dorothy Thompson had an article a few days later, and Wells later credited her with kind of turning the tide of public opinion. And she said that the press should be thanking Orson Welles for exposing how susceptible the country was to panic. And she said, it's not her exact words, but she referred to how a panicked nation will do things like, and she basically predicted the Red Scare and things of that nature. So it's very interesting, the different views that came out in the media.
There were, for example, in the power of suggestion category, reports residents of Riverside, New York, reported to baffled police seeing Martian machines poised on the Jersey Palisades, preparing to cross the Hudson on their way to attack New York City. Somebody says, I stuck my head out of the window and thought I could smell the gas.
Right.
And the greenish, eerie light somebody else saw when they looked out the window, they were sure it came from a monster. The New York Times reported patrolman John Morrison, who was on duty at Bronx Police Headquarters, when all of the phones lit up. The first call he answered started with a man who informed him, they're bombing New Jersey. How do you know? Morrison asks. Well, I heard it on the radio. Imagine that. And I went to the roof, and I could see smoke from the bombs drifting over toward New York. What shall I do?
I mean, I think of
how many hundred thousands of those do you need before you have a country in trouble?
I know. Well, I think about, it's like you look at the cranes that were probably, along the, especially knowing New York a little bit, you had all those where the boats are coming in, and you had cranes lifting things off that against the skyline, or if it's a, some kind of ship belching smoke, or all the factories over there, all of a sudden it's like your mind could really play a trick on you that this is what's happening, very definitely.
Any significance to the fact that War of the Worlds was moved from England to New Jersey?
Well, Koch wanted it somewhere in the United States. And what he did is he was on a road trip, so he just grabbed a road map and stuck his pencil somewhere, and it landed in Grover's Mill. And that's how he decided on the location. So it was just to make it more believable and relatable for an American audience, which he was very successful.
But by a remarkable coincidence, 1938 was the year that Our Town came out, big hit on Broadway, and that was set in Grover's Corners. New Hampshire.
Right.
The all-American town.
Right, and it's really amazing is that when you listen to the story, there are, especially in that opening that you read, Norman, too, from H.G. Wells, is there really is a sense between that, as well as when the professor later on talks about life, that really sounds like Thornton Wilder as he's talking about his town and walking down the streets and what he might be giving up. It's like Emily saying goodbye. Goodbye coffee, goodbye town and all that. I mean, it really is a strong, strong similarities in the kind of language that it is. I don't know if it's a coincidence. It's where, again, where we are creatively, where all of a sudden we all start to think the same things. And, it's like consciousness starts to bring it about. I'm not really sure. But I know the one thing that I wanted to do with this play was to bring it home. And just as Koch did, I wanted this play to have a sense of being local. And so I think the audience will be quite surprised to find that the locales in this play are a lot closer than they think. It's not Grover's Mills, but Black Earth, and we talk about all the different places in Wisconsin to bring it home. And I think that in itself will give it a real flair, and hopefully there will not, you know, the phones won't be lighting up anywhere around in our police stations.
Well, that's an interesting point, isn't it? I mean, you want people to be scared, though, don't you?
Well, I want – scared, well, no.
What do you want out of them, Tony?
Well, first of all, I want them to come see the show as well as tune in. There's a broadcast in Wisconsin Public Radio on October 4th. But I also – I want them to think about what is happening at that time. As we're celebrating the 70th anniversary of this piece and the broadcast, I want them to actually kind of think about – and not be frightened, but, you know, that feeling of, could that happen here? I mean, and what is it like to actually – when there is a disaster, like just recently when we had like Lake Delton, you know, and all of a sudden you're getting reports of houses floating away and people perishing and roads are covered. And I mean, it's rivers are turning their course into different configurations. And today now we have the benefit of film and video to give us an actual eyewitness account. But when you're just hearing that on the radio, it's a whole different experience of what you imagine is going on. And so that's what I love about what we're doing here, is that when people hear Black Earth and other towns around, I hope they get a strong sense of what would it be if these kind of things were actually happening right here in Dane County, in Sun Prairie. You know, what would be happening if smoke was coming across the marshes of Monona? You know, so I hope it creates at least a little bit of a chill, but not real fright.
More with War of the Worlds when we continue in a moment with University of the Year.
Down the rivage we float, the logs they make the ground a boat. On the logs we leap and laugh as safe upon the logs as on the run. There's a rock, watch out, mon frere, you maybe get a big shipwreck there. The sun is shining on the shore, we see big salmon shore.
Ladies and gentlemen, following on the news given in our bulletin a moment ago, the Government Meteorological Bureau has requested the large observatories of the country to keep an astronomical watch on any further disturbances occurring on the planet Mars. Due to the unusual nature of this occurrence, we have arranged an interview with a noted astronomer, Professor Pearson, who will give us his views on this event. In a few moments, we will take you to the Princeton Observatory at Princeton, New Jersey. We return you until then to the music of Ramon Raquello and his orchestra.
What do Nelson Eddy and events on Mars have in common? Well, so far as we know, this is the first time anybody's done this on radio. We found the place where about 3 million people tuned out of the Chase and Sanborn Hour and therefore tuned in late to the War of the Worlds and took it as real news. I'm Norman Gilliland, back with Emily Auerbach and our guests for this hour, Tony Simotas, Bethany Wood, Sarah Lyons, and John Hawes, and we're talking about the War of the Worlds, and in particular, the very latest production of it, which is being done jointly by University Theater and Wisconsin Public Radio. Tony, you mentioned a minute or so ago that you were going to bring this home to Wisconsin, and instead of being in England, where H.G. Wells said it, or in New Jersey, where Orson Welles and Howard Koch said it, right down to Wisconsin. Is it coincidental that Wells was from Wisconsin, Orson Welles? Is that what you're up to here?
Well, that wasn't it, but I think Bethany has something that she would like to share with us before I go into why I felt it was important to mention Madison and Black Earth and all the other surrounding communities.
Well, the connection with Wisconsin and Orson Welles is pretty interesting, and I do have to credit my fellow dramaturg Shannon Skelton with some of this research, but it's said that Orson Welles once said, "I'm not ashamed of being from Wisconsin, just of being from Kenosha." So he was, in fact, from Wisconsin.
Don't take it personally, listeners to WGTD.
No,
this
I'm only
is not
quoting
a statement.
But he wasn't very happy about that. And there's also a UW connection. In 1925, Welles was brought to Madison to be studied by the child prodigy psychologist F.G. Mueller at the University of Wisconsin. And he lived here with Mueller and his family near campus and attended Camp Indianola in the summer, which was directly across Lake Mendota from UW. And it was while there he wrote his own adaptation of Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde and performed that. So
at the age of 10?
Yes.
And wow. Amazing story.
He was in the Child Prodigy program, so I guess we know why.
But very talented and very gifted.
There was a direct UW connection, which is really exciting.
Well, I find that that was the thing that we have talked about in rehearsal, is that the amazing connections to how this project, which seemingly came out of nowhere, and in some respects, because it was not the project we originally were going for. Originally, we were looking at doing a Rod Serling piece, and out of our partnership last year, Norman and I started chatting, and we thought, well, let's keep this going. And we were able to store the set from last year's production, which is really quite beautiful. And we started looking at Rod Serling. And through any number of stops and starts and unfortunately a few detours, the Serling project is still put on hold because of legal issues. And War of the Worlds was floated. And so it's almost like synchronicity in that we came to the War of the Worlds, and then all of these other tie-ins to UW and to Orson Welles and Wisconsin, Kenosha, and other events that happened around this extraordinary night in America in 1938 started to come to fruition for us, whether in rehearsal or stories that kept coming back. And so I really wanted this story to be about this area, because I kept trying to find what would be the hook. You know, people, if you tell them they're coming to see the War of the Worlds, obviously they know already that it's a bit of a fake. And so we're also doing on that night a story, The Monkey's Paw. And The Monkey's Paw is kind of our hook for the evening to do a live theater piece for the first time on WHA back in 1938. And so that's kind of our premise, that the audience will come in and start to see the Wisconsin Players, which is what our theater program was called at that time. And, oh, Bethany, do you have
the mission statement?
The mission statement, do you know it offhand?
Their mission statement was something about how drama and radio were beneficial to the development of one's personality.
Right. Mm-hmm. And so I think that we tried to tie in as many local kind of hooks for that era. So we talk about Washburn Observatory. We discuss the city as Madison in that time frame and campus in that time frame, so that when people are listening, it's really kind of a little bit of a historical journey. But I really wanted it to be a sense that, I guess, unbeknownst to myself, I didn't realize what, you know, Koch and Welles were going for was that feeling of the marshes in New Jersey. But I really want to feel like the marshes here, and that people would hear these things and actually in their own mind's eye see Black Earth, see Fitchburg, you know, see what Chicago, Milwaukee might have looked like at that time. And all the Foley work that we're doing, Jack Sayer and his wonderful crew is bringing in just the sights and almost the smells and sounds of what Madison might have been like in 1938.
Can you set up a scene of the show?
Ooh, well,
speaking of observatories.
Yes, observatories. Yes, I can. Well, you know, it's just interesting, too, is that I believe the observatory is right now undergoing renovation on campus. So it's so great to have that structure still with us. And hopefully after this broadcast, there'll be even renewed interest in the observatory on campus. Well, the scene we're going to take a look at is when the correspondent, the reporter at the time, is going to interview Professor Pearson. And he's at the observatory looking at Mars. And the first bulletin has come in that a flash of light has been seen around the world. And so the station has sent out their reporter. And we call her Rita Phillips, as opposed to, it was originally cast as a man.
Carl Phillips.
But because I had a talented actress in Sarah Lyons, she became Rita Phillips. So we've made changes to sexes of certain characters throughout and changed the names to protect the innocent. And so we're going to see it's Rita Phillips interviewing Professor Pearson in the observatory on the night there was an explosion on Mars.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. This is Rita Phillips speaking to you from the observatory at Madison. I am standing in a large, semicircular room, pitch black except for an oblong split in the ceiling. Through this opening, I can see a sprinkling of stars that cast a kind of frosty glow over the intricate mechanism of the huge telescope. The ticking sound you hear is the vibration of the clockwork. Professor Pearson stands directly above me on a small platform, peering through a giant lens. I ask you to be patient, ladies and gentlemen, during any delay that may arise during our interview. Besides his ceaseless watch of the heavens, Professor Pearson may be interrupted by telephone or other communications. During this period, he is in constant touch with the astronomical centers of the world. Professor, may I begin our questions?
At any time, Miss Phillips.
Professor, would you please tell our radio audience exactly what you see as you observe the planet Mars through your telescope?
Well, nothing unusual at the moment, Miss Phillips. A red disk swimming in a blue sea, transverse stripes across the disk. Quite distinct now, because Mars happens to be at its point nearest to Earth, in opposition, as we call it.
In your opinion, what do these transverse stripes signify, Professor Pearson?
Not canals, I can assure you, Miss Phillips. Although that's the popular conjecture of those who imagine Mars to be inhabited. From a scientific viewpoint, the stripes are merely the result of atmospheric conditions peculiar to the planet.
Then you're quite convinced, as a scientist, that living intelligence as we know it does not exist on Mars?
I'd say the chances against it are 1,000 to 1.
And yet, how do you account for those gas eruptions occurring on the surface of the planet at regular intervals?
Well, Miss Phillips, I cannot account for it.
By the way, Professor, for the benefit of our listeners, how far is Mars from Earth?
Approximately 40 million miles.
Well, that seems a safe enough distance.
Oh, thank you.
Just a moment, ladies and gentlemen. Someone has just handed Professor Pearson a message. While he reads it, let me remind you that we are speaking to you from the Washburn Observatory in Madison, Wisconsin, where we are interviewing the world-famous astronomer Professor Pearson. One moment, please. Professor Pearson has passed me a message which he has just received. Professor, may I read the message to the listening audience?
Why, certainly, Miss Phillips.
Ladies and gentlemen, I shall read you a wire addressed to Professor Pearson from Dr. Gray at the University of Chicago's Yerkes Observatory. 8:15 p.m. Central Standard Time. Seismograph registered shock of almost earthquake intensity occurring within a radius of 50 miles of Madison. Please investigate. Signed, Lloyd Gray, Chief of Astronomical Division. Professor Pearson, could this occurrence possibly have something to do with the disturbances observed on the planet Mars?
Hardly, Miss Phillips. This is probably a meteorite of unusual size, and its arrival at this particular time is merely coincidence. However, we shall conduct a search as soon as daylight permits.
Thank you, Professor. Ladies and gentlemen, for the past 10 minutes, we've been speaking to you from the observatory at Madison, bringing you a special interview with Professor Pearson, noted astronomer. This is Rita Phillips speaking. We are returning you now to our studio.
Well, how convenient. I guess that's our cue. Thank you. Now, in the original, I'll say the original, by which I mean not H.G. Wells, but I mean Orson Welles, which isn't really, of course, quite true. But in the Orson Welles version, Carl Phillips is talking to Professor Pearson. How does it change the scene? How does it change the dynamics when you change Carl Phillips into Rita Phillips?
Well, I think what happens a little bit is we have a little bit more of a flirtatious relationship between the two. And it really, as I was talking to Sarah just the other night in rehearsal about it, was in that time frame, you know, women had such great roles in films. And there were any number of movies in which kind of like My Gal Friday and others where women had really strong, and say what we call today, pants roles. And so to me, it really fit with the feeling of that time in film where women took really strong roles, and whether it's Katharine Hepburn or Betty Davis and Claudette Colbert, they were just such strong female figures that it felt really right in the situation. It became advantageous to us to make it a female role. And then it really fit with the time frame. And so I think having this kind of flirtation between the two of them in a way was really quite nice. And so if I was doing the movie, I think I would leave it this way because I think it adds a really nice feeling of the scientist who's kind of caught up in his work, and here comes this reporter to kind of disrupt his world a little bit and throws him off. And I won't tell you what happens to Reed Phillips. I think you have to come see the play or tune in on October 4th to find out.
We also hear the growing, well, the skepticism of the scientists helps maybe if you're a listener and you have a figure on stage who's skeptical, that sort of matches your skepticism. So when the scientist starts to have to believe, that sort of draws us along with it. Actually, right. When Rita was doing her part, I was also thinking about the number of newscasters today who will be reading the news and smiling while telling about an earthquake or
right.
You know, sort of the disconnect between the newscaster and what they're actually handed to read can
right.
be quite interesting.
And it also raises the stakes for her character a little bit because this was a time when women didn't broadcast the news. It was considered too harsh and women might break down and cry. So all the newscasters were men. And, you know, this is a night where for some reason they couldn't find a guy to send.
Yeah, right.
So she got this job and this is her chance. This is her big break. So not only is tonight the story of the Martian invasion, but it's the story of Rita Phillips' chance to make it. And it's a woman fighting for her place in a man's world, which along with, you know, His Girl Friday, that's why these roles were so great, because it was a chance when women were coming into the workforce and making opportunities where there weren't any.
Right. I think you'll see that actually throughout the whole play is there are a number of the roles are played by women in different ways that really punctuate what was happening in society at that time. And the show looks wonderful because they're all in the late 30s costumes. So the audience comes in and sees them dressed in specific ways. And Rachel Barnett has just done a great job with the look. And I think you'll really, really get a chance to see women cut a different silhouette on stage than they would in today's kind of media-driven audience. It's just it's a different feeling.
That reporting style, did Orson Welles have anybody in particular in mind when he came up with that voice for Carl Phillips? Was there any particular effect he was after?
I don't know if Carl Phillips directed the actor. I mean, I don't know if Welles directed the actor who's
right.
playing Carl Phillips, but he actually went and listened to reports of the Hindenburg disaster.
Herb Morrison, yeah.
Yes, and he listened to Morrison over and over and over, just that tone going from something that's exciting and a wonderful thing to be reporting about technology and the advances of humankind. We listened to the broadcast in rehearsal. He's talking about
right.
American Airlines and how they were able to fly across the country and what an amazing thing that was. And it's so fascinating to hear it when we're so jaded about flying these days and to listen to when it was still new and exciting. And then you hear this wonderful moment go horribly wrong and turn into a disaster. And he listened to that to use during the broadcast of The Martians when it's this thing that everyone's curious about and what is it? And then it turns into a horrible massacre. And so he listened to the Hindenburg broadcast, which was one of, I think it was the first disaster that was broadcast. It was recorded and then that recording was made live and then broadcast.
Well, it was amazing, Norman, when we played the Hindenburg recording in rehearsal. And still to this day, the effect, listening to his voice and the scene was so terrifying. I mean, you know, I know myself. I had tears in my eyes. Other people did as well. And it was quite moving, really moving, listening to the suffering and his description of what he was seeing. We do have another scene, though, which is not quite as tragic or wrenching. But what we get in the next scene is where Rita Phillips travels with Professor Pearson out to the Olson Farm near Black Earth in our production, where this, I guess, foreign object has plunged into the earth, breaking trees with it as it's gone along. We don't know what it is. And they've made this journey, according to our script, in a remarkable, just in minutes from downtown Madison to Black Earth. And what's even more remarkable is that when I just picked Olson out of the air one night in rehearsal, I was on my way out to the American Players Theater to see a production, and there, unbeknownst to me, is the Olson Farm just outside of Black Earth. So
talk about the Twilight Zone.
Talk about the Twilight Zone. So in this scene, what we have is a Rita Phillips, and of course, when you come see the play, there's any number of sound effects and Foley work going along with this and her description, but this is what she sees when she pulls up to the farm there in Black Earth on this remarkable night.
Ladies and gentlemen, this is Rita Phillips again at the Olson Farm, Black Earth, Wisconsin. Professor Pearson and myself made the 20 miles from Madison in just minutes. Well, I... I hardly know where to begin to paint for you a word picture of the strange scene before my eyes, like something out of a modern Arabian Nights. Well, I just got here. I haven't had a chance to look around yet. I guess that's it. Yes, I guess that's the thing directly in front of me, half buried in a vast pit. Must have struck with terrific force. The ground is covered with splinters of a tree it must have struck on its way down. What I can see of the object itself doesn't look very much like a meteor, at least not the meteors I've seen. It looks more like a huge cylinder. It has a diameter of... What would you say, Professor Pearson?
What's that, Miss Phillips?
What would you say? What is the diameter?
About 30 yards.
About 30 yards. The metal on the sheath is... Well, I've never seen anything like it. The color is sort of yellowish-white. Curious spectators are now pressing close to the object in spite of the efforts of the police to keep them back. They're getting in front of my line of vision. Would you mind standing to one side, please? While the policemen are pushing the crowd back, here's Mr. Olson, owner of the farm here. He may have some interesting facts to add.
And that brings us back to Farmer Olson, who then tells us how he was jostled out of his chair as he saw the remarkable events unfold that night as he was listening to his radio. If we can now fast forward in our story, we come back now to Professor Pearson. After the disaster has taken place, there has been a rather unfortunate event where the Martian spaceship has showed its strength and devastated the countryside with an incredible machine and flame-throwing device. We'll let Professor Pearson, though, when he's on a radio hookup back to the studio, he tells the listening audience what he saw as he was on the Olson farm.
Of the creatures in the rocket cylinder at Black Earth, I can give you no authoritative information, either as to their nature, their origin, or their purposes here on Earth. Of their destructive instrument, I might venture some conjectural explanation. For want of a better term, I shall refer to the mysterious weapon as a heat ray. It's all too evident that these creatures have scientific knowledge far in advance of our own. And it is my guess that in some way they are able to generate an intense heat in a chamber of practically absolute non-conductivity. This intense heat they project in a parallel beam against any object they choose by means of a polished parabolic mirror of unknown composition. Much as the mirror of a lighthouse projects a beam of light. And that is my conjecture of the origin of the heat ray.
He doesn't sound quite so confident as he did when he was talking to Rita Phillips.
He's had a rough night.
But it shows the way we all listen to this voice of science when we're used to being kind of awed by terms and we see him looking for things to say to put in words what's happening.
Right, and that's what I think that, you know, just working with John on this too, was it is the scientist who's trying to make sense of a situation that he's never seen before. And I think this is still true today. I mean, I just read about an ant that was discovered just a couple of years ago down in subterranean ant that is called actually something from Mars because no one had ever seen this ant ever before. And it's a blind ant living underground. And so it's interesting that Mars is still being used as the otherworldly kind of sense of discovery. So I think it is interesting to see a scientist who's always felt very sure of himself now caught in a situation where all his training, nothing adds up to being able to really discern what is happening.
So what was the outcome of War of the Worlds? More in a moment with University of the Year.
It is reported that at 8:15 p.m., a huge flaming object, believed to be a meteorite, fell on a farm near Black Earth, Wisconsin, 20 miles from Madison. The flash in the sky was visible within a radius of several hundred miles, and the noise of the impact was heard as far north as Sauk City. We have dispatched a special mobile unit to the scene, and we'll have our commentator and reporter Rita Phillips give you a word description as soon as she can reach there from Madison.
That's one of the news bulletins from the current University Theater production of War of the Worlds, which opens September 26. I'm Emily Auerbach, back with Norman Gilliland. And with us is Tony Simotas, the director, also Bethany Wood, who is the dramaturg and assistant director, and two of the actors, Sarah Lyons and John Hawes. Tony, when we heard Norman read that opening bulletin, it's got that voice of the announcer, the voice of the newscaster, and I know you're making use of him in the actual production, but tell me something about what a newscaster in this time period in the 1930s sounded like and what effect that has on us.
Well, I think the thing that's really important is, especially for radio, is that the voices of the radio really kind of make a difference in terms of how we interpret what we're hearing, literally. And Norman just has, you know, a great voice. And in fact, we make use of that voice throughout the show. And he's actually playing in character. His name is Thomas Gleason. And we actually introduce him as Thomas Gleason in the show. And he is the voice of WHA. And I really wanted Norman's involvement in the show. We had such a great time last year working on The Water Engine. And when Norman and I started talking about doing this, finally at one point I said, Norman, would you like to be in the show? and he said yes. And it was pretty amazing because I said, now, you know, this is going to be a lot of work. You're going to have to be there a lot of nights. And he signed on, and it's been really great because this kind of production has so many bulletins being read, it was important that the radio voice have real authority and a sense of the time period. And as you said, I think in the 30s, people were used to more language. And so we've actually had to cut some elements out of the show because I think audiences at that time would actually listen more readily to longer passages on the radio. And at that time, because language was probably more dense in some respects than it is today, we're more used to clipped language and shortening phrases and using acronyms to describe things. The audience then would take the time to listen more thoroughly, I think, to what was going on. And the style, I always imagine, is when I, again, think of entertainment at that time, it had a kind of clippedness to it, and it still went on, and they kept talking like this. Ladies and gentlemen, it's so glad to have you here right at the Palladium Theater in downtown Los Angeles. And there was a kind of quality about you had to really be entertaining with your voice and being able to color the scene, so to speak, for the audience at home.
But the newscaster also has that voice of God. It's a little bit like the movie trailer voice, isn't it? It's usually very low. Right. And it just has that.
Imagine a time, a century long ago. That kind of thing.
Yeah.
Right. Yes, it plays it out in lots of different ways.
And it's important, too, that they were all male voices.
Yes. Right.
And
credibility. That credibility.
The idea of integrity and credibility.
And I understand, Tony, that you also have sort of are playing a role in this
production. A cameo.
Yeah, I guess. I'm way in the back. And what happened was during the rehearsals, I was just kind of reading this one part, the secretary of whatever.
Interior?
Interior, yes.
The secretary of the interior. And so just in it's interesting, the way it is written, it has a very particular rhythm to it. And so using Norman as my intro, I'll do the voice of the secretary. This is what you'll hear coming over the sound system of the theater.
We now take you to Washington for a special report on the national emergency. The Secretary of the Interior.
Citizens of the nation, I shall not try to conceal the gravity of the situation that confronts the country, nor the concern of your government in protecting the lives and property of its people. However, I wish to impress upon you, private citizens and public officials, all of you, the urgent need of calm and resourceful action. Fortunately, this formidable enemy is still confined to a comparatively small area, and we may place our faith in the military forces to keep them there. In the meantime, placing our faith in God, we must continue the performance of our duties, each and every one of us, so that we may confront this destructive adversary with a nation united, courageous, and consecrated to the preservation of human supremacy on this earth. I thank you, God bless you, and God bless America.
echoes of FDR in that voice, yes, for sure.
A little bit. It wanted to have a feeling of, you know, of the time, and that kind of sound just seemed to work.
No FEMA appearance in the show?
No FEMA. No. No, but I really find it interesting, again, is that you cannot help but see the show, and I think, and hear the echoes of the news that surrounds us right now in this play, whether it's about the other represented by other nations, what might be waiting for us. There's all the questions even of space right now, in terms of they're on Mars right now, digging through the surface and finding crystals of old water. The idea that these headlines in the War of the Worlds are really still very active in media and the world today all around us.
Just a word or two about what became of the principals involved in War of the Worlds. If we're talking about Orson Welles and the scriptwriter Howard Koch and John Houseman, for that matter.
Welles, of course, went on to Hollywood, but not before Campbell's Soup picked up sponsorship of Mercury Theater on the air, which everyone was very pleased with. And that was mainly due to War of the Worlds and its success. And it's said that a lot of his work in radio with sound affected how he used sound in Citizen Kane. Koch also went to Hollywood, wrote Casablanca, but there was forever a dispute about which one of them was responsible for the brilliance of War of the Worlds, and Welles always claimed it was him, and Koch, however, maintained the copyright, so we won't really know the answer to that dispute. John Houseman, some people might know as Professor Kingsfield from The Paper Chase, the movie and the TV show. He also went to Hollywood to work with Welles on Citizen Kane, but they had a dispute and parted ways. So that's pretty much how the principal players of the Welles version ended up.
And I understand there was panic when the production was done later in Ecuador and a few other places that War of the Worlds, the sort of panic reaction to this production didn't end with that broadcast in 1938.
No, it's amazing. There have been multiple productions, and Quito, they tried the same thing, updating it, making it local. And this production was done in 1949 in Ecuador. And unfortunately, the panic escalated to quite an extent, and there was a mob in the street by the time it was announced that this was actually a hoax. And this was different than Welles' production in that it was not a regularly scheduled drama program. They just inserted this drama in the form of news bulletins into a regular program, and people were furious, and several of them had gasoline, and they went to the radio station and burned it down.
Oh, my God.
And the police were not around when they were called because they were actually headed off to help defend against the Martians. And so when the station burned down, the other buildings were not affected, but unfortunately 20 people were killed in the incident. And so that's the most fatalities caused by this work. But that was in 1949. There have been other productions. There was a production in Buffalo in 1968, and NPR had its own revival production in 1988. Fortunately, those were without fatalities.
And that's what we're hoping for this time around. Yes. When we broadcast as well.
And we'll put a link to the University Theater website on our webpage at wpr.org/universitytheair.
Thanks for joining us and filling us in about the War of the Worlds. Our guests have been Tony Simotas, the director, the dramaturg and assistant director, Bethany Wood, and two actors, Sarah Lyons and John Hawes. Thanks one and all for being with us.
Thank you.
Thank you for having us today.
I'm Norman Gilliland with Emily Auerbach, and I hope you can join us for the next hour of University of the Air. Next Sunday afternoon at 4 during University of the Air, Maestro John Demain of the Madison Symphony is with us to enlighten us about how much difference a conductor makes in an orchestral performance. That's next Sunday afternoon at 4, University of the Air. Join us right here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.